what I decided to do is calculate how much each one of these lawmakers took from the NRA and just begin posting those numbers, right? Quote tweet every tweet and say, the reason why at Paul Ryan is only thinking and praying about gun violence and not actually doing anything is because he took X amount of dollars from the NRA.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Igor Volsky is founder and executive director of Guns Down America, a group working to build a future with fewer guns by building political and cultural support for policies that will help keep us safe from gun violence. He's author of Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns. Igor previously served as deputy director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and as vice president at the Center for American Progress. Igor has a good story about his career in politics and how he came to build his part of the Progressive Coalition. He's well worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Igor Volsky at Guns Down America.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplot's library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Igor, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yes, my name is Igor Volsky. I'm the executive director of Guns Down America, an organization I started in 2016 after accidentally creating a bit of a firestorm with tweets that shamed lawmakers for sending thoughts and prayers after mass shootings and not actually doing anything to help build safer communities.
What was your position when you were sharing these tweets?
For a long time, I worked at the Center for American Progress on a whole host of different issues. I started my career working on healthcare, particularly Obamacare, and then moved into doing more general advocacy work. And at the time of those tweets that took place in early December, I was working in video, making progressive videos, and really just out of great anger after the San Bernardino shooting of seeing these lawmakers who had voted against gun reform after the Newtown shooting. There was an opportunity to do something. And now, you know, several years later, they were pretending to actually care about the survivors and the first responders in that San Bernardino shooting. And it just struck me as incredibly disingenuous. It seemed like they were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of their constituents. And I got fed up and I decided to call them out.
Makes sense. Just to catch myself up on you, give me a quick sense of your path. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? How did you end up at the Center for American
sure.
Progress?
So I grew up in the Soviet Union. And I think actually it was my early experiences there that pushed me into progressive politics because we're Jewish. And at the time, and I think this is still the case today and in many parts of Russia and Ukraine and some of the other republics, that it was very difficult to be Jewish. You had very limited opportunity for higher education. There was a whole lot of anti-Semitism. And I remember when I was about four or five, I had pulled a piano onto myself from banging it, pretending to play it. And I ended up in a hospital ward with kids who were around my same age. So they were 3 or 4 or 5. And at that point, my last name wasn't Volsky. My last name was Katzman, Igor Katzman. It's a very Jewish last name. And the kids at that hospital ward knew that. And they started to make fun of me for being Jewish. It was my very first time, very first experience with anti-Semitism. And I came back home and I told my mom what had happened. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, you don't look particularly Jewish. Maybe if we change our last name, things are going to be easier for you. And at the time, there was an earthquake in the country of Georgia. And the man who was running the recovery effort and, you know, hopefully doing a really good job, his last name was Volsky. And we thought, aha, Volsky sounds more Polish than Jewish. And so we became the Volskys. But I tell that story because our lived experience in the Soviet Union was incredibly different than how politicians or Soviet lawmakers described our life, right? We were all supposed to be equal. We were all supposed to have all of this amazing opportunity that socialism, or Soviet socialism, I should say, provided for us. But the reality was very different. And I think what happened once we immigrated to America and kind of I came of age and began to wake up politically is that that gap between what politicians say and what politicians actually do really it kind of brought me back to those early experiences in the Soviet Union and really motivated me to get into the fight of politics, into the movement of politics. And I think certainly it was directly responsible for pushing me into the gun reform movement.
I feel some kinship with your story there, though my Jewish relatives from that part of the world came closer to the turn from the 19th century to the 20th. I'm several generations down the road here. But, you know, I think that that immigrant experience and that experience of the politics elsewhere, where ours was, there was a good reason for my relatives to leave too, does affect people here in this country so much.
Well, and, you know, when you come to America, or at least my experience as a direct immigrant, you try to soak up so much of this new country you're living in, and you learn about the founding story, you learn about the ideals of the nation in a different way than folks who are naturally born into this country or any country. And at least for me, there was always the temptation to ensure that the country actually lives up to the founding ideals that I learned about, that I romanticized about. That part of the immigrant experience also played a major factor in me beginning to express interest in politics and policy and ultimately working in that field.
How old were you when you came over?
7. I was 7.
So definitely a huge change for a 7-year-old, but a long time to assimilate.
Yeah, it really was. We had lived in Israel for 2 years before that. And so I had experienced that culture and had obviously learned Hebrew, went to first grade in Israel, and just the experience of having to readjust yet again, learn a new language yet again, try to fit in with a new group of friends and make friends yet again, I think certainly was formative.
What part of the U.S. did you move to and how was that?
So we moved to New Jersey, and my parents still live in New Jersey. We initially immigrated to Newark and lived in a really poor area of Newark, an area where, you know, it really, I think, shocked us in many ways just how difficult that area was. Soon after we moved, you know, my parents worked very hard, as you can imagine. And this is also, I think, a typical aspect of an immigrant story. I remember my stepdad, when we first came over, one of his jobs was working at a gas station. As another one of his jobs, he was delivering newspapers. and then eventually was able to work more closely with his cousin, who had already come to the United States some years prior and became a licensed electrician, and still actually does that body of work and now has his own business. I remember being really impressed by the work ethic. I remember being impressed by the perseverance, this notion that, you know, we are willing to do whatever it takes to be successful. And also, frankly, though, being aware that it's not just the hard work of the individual that will lead to progress and success, that you need the community as a whole to help lift you up. And I say that because I remember for some time, I think it was a year, you know, we received food stamps and those kinds of benefits were incredibly helpful for us in the very beginning as we were trying to make our way and to make our life. I think there might have also been some subsidized housing in the beginning, although I don't remember. I point those out though, because I think oftentimes in the telling of the immigrant story, that story always oftentimes focuses on individuals working really hard, kind of pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. That is certainly a part of the immigrant story. But what's also a part of it are some of the programs that are in place, that have been in place for decades, that help folks to make ends meet and to lead to a better life. Obviously, public education is a part of that. Part of my attraction to progressive politics, because, you know, I became politically aware actually through conservative talk radio, but part of my rejection of that philosophy, I think, really had to do with those early experiences with social services as well.
And you went to Marist College and majored in history?
I did, yes. At that college, I was one of the few very political folks on campus. I had a political radio show and was just kind of very energetic about doing work in politics.
So it sounds like after college, it was most of a career at Center for American Progress in a variety of different ways. Think Progress is part of that too, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that as a place to work and some of the highlights of your time there.
I first got into politics because I would walk home from school and I would listen to the radio on my Walkman, and I discovered people like Bob Grant and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, who, you know, are conservative talkers. Bob Grant, who you may or may not know, is kind of considered the grandfather of conservative talk, and is a man who's no longer with us, but really kind of championed the kind of anti-immigrant, anti-black and brown people philosophy that is so popular on conservative talk radio. And in searching for alternatives to that point of view, I discovered the Progress Report, which is a publication that still exists. But at the time, in 2002 or 3, I want to say, was a pre-blog publication that provided, during the Bush years, some much needed framing and talking points to Democrats and to progressives. And I remember I used to read it every day. I would print it out. I would highlight it. I would create an entire binder full of these reports. And so by the time I got to college and started to look for internships, I thought, well, let me see if I could intern at the Center for American Progress. At that point in 2007, they had started Think Progress, and I eventually began my career in May of 2007 as an intern at Think Progress. And I have to say, I was incredibly impressed from the very beginning, and at the time, it was a very small team of, I want to say, 5 or 6 people. I was impressed by the dedication. I was impressed by the incredible hard work. I was impressed by a culture that was very much in this place of, you know, our country under George W. Bush is headed in the wrong direction, and we have to do whatever it takes to try and make progress. And I think I really, you know, soaked up that kind of ethos. It was set by a man by the name of Faz Shakir, who was at the time was the editor-in-chief of Think Progress and would later go on to become Bernie Sanders' campaign manager in this last run. Actually, a lot of my, and I don't actually think I've ever talked about this publicly, but I'm happy to, I think a lot of my drive that I have and have had throughout my career is really, frankly, a testament to the values that he held and to the work ethic that I'm sure he still has. And so I will forever be grateful. The other thing I'll say is by the time I came on to Think Progress full-time, which was after I graduated in late May of 2008, I began my career there as a healthcare policy analyst, where I would spend most of my time trying to communicate to folks why, at that time, John McCain's healthcare plan was far inferior to what then candidate Obama had put forward, and really became an expert to some degree in healthcare policy. The pivotal moment for me early on, and something that I'm still very impressed by, is this was my first job out of college. I knew relatively little about healthcare policy, right? I had also only been doing the job for maybe a year or a couple of months. I don't remember. When John Podesta, who at that time was the president of the Center for American Progress, and as you know, had a very distinguished career in Democratic politics and was President Bill Clinton's chief of staff and et cetera, and also worked in the Obama White House. He approached me, I think, through FAS because he had been contacted by Howard Dean, who was looking to write a book about healthcare policy. They brought me into this project, and I ended up working with the governor and also with FAS on that book, and was able to, in 2009, put out a book on healthcare policy. I say that not to highlight the book necessarily, although I still think it very much holds up in some respects. But I say that because, you know, the leaders of the Center for American Progress really believed in investing in young people, in giving young people opportunities, in giving young people the chance to kind of stand up and show what they're capable of. And that was just absolutely life-changing and confidence-building and so incredibly important to me. Because here I was, you know, an immigrant kid whose family wasn't particularly political, although, you know, my folks are on the more conservative side of the spectrum. And so I just felt, I think, very proud that they would have that confidence in me. And certainly after I left and really throughout my career, I've really tried to mirror that kind of approach.
I've had both Fez and Howard Dean on the show, and
have they not talked about the book?
I don't recall that they either of them did, but it strikes me that for someone just out of college to have that kind of experience with people who either were going to be or at that level writing a book, you know, it's kind of a testament to what it's like in politics, how permeable it is and how important it is to get in with the right set of people on the right set of projects. I'm envious of you having that experience. What was Dean like to work with on a project like that?
Well, I only knew Howard Dean really before the project from, as we now remember, in 2004, that scream heard around the world right after what he came in second in Iowa, or I don't remember the details of the context exactly.
I feel like third, maybe.
Third, maybe. I remembered watching that speech. And so that was my sense of him going in to the meetings that we had and to the conversations that we had. My first impression of Howard, I remember that he just had a million ideas. He was firing on all cylinders. He just had such a kind of infectious energy about him. And he had given me, when we first started the project, he had given me transcripts that some company had transcribed of things he said into a tape recorder that would form the backbone of the book. And it was my task to translate that into prose and into some structure. I found that to be actually a really exciting challenge and a really exciting opportunity. The other thing I'll say is that when I got a lot of the draft to him, what really surprised me is he and I spent definitely several days, or maybe it was just many, many hours in one day, I don't remember, but meticulously going over every single sentence, which I think also imprinted on me the importance of paying attention to details and the importance of being kind of very specific in what you're trying to accomplish and how you're trying to say it. And, you know, he was also, I think, a very, very generous in how he approached this project. He chose to put our names, Faz and my name, on the cover of the book, which is not something he had to do. That was incredibly generous. We attended, I think, several book events, or at least a book party that was held in his honor. And he, you know, recognized us publicly in a way that I think many people in that kind of position wouldn't. You know, that struck me as very kind and very generous and frankly, in some ways, very unexpected. And I'll also say that it was at that Howard Dean book party in 2009 where I first met Neera Tanden, who, of course, would then become my boss several years later at the center.
Yeah. So you kind of worked your way over something like 6 years through different roles, different kinds of editorships, into managing editor, right, at Think Progress. What were some of the things that you remember most?
So from 2008 to 2010, so Obamacare passed in March of 2010, I did exclusively healthcare in the spirit of people giving young people opportunities. You'll remember in 2009, 2010, obviously, the Affordable Care Act was the main topic of conversation politically and on television. And that's when I really got some of my first opportunities to appear on cable news to talk about healthcare. I absolutely loved doing that. I love having kind of rhetorical arguments with folks and having the opportunity to persuade audiences and people who may disagree with me of things, and has really continued as an opportunity for me. But it really started with healthcare. I'll remember the day President Obama signed that BFD law. I was watching it on television, and we're sitting in the office, and I send a chat to Faz, who was sitting behind me, but the culture was such that we did most of our talking because everyone was writing and working all the time. We did most of our talking over chat. I said to him, you know what? Now that healthcare is done, maybe I could explore writing about other topics as well. And I say that for two reasons, because I thought it'd be done in 2010, right? How foolish.
Still working on it.
Still working on it. And yes. And second, I always operated, and I think this is also something I got from my parents, under this theory of try to make yourself really indispensable in an organization and try to add value where you can, and to add value in ways that other people may not be. At the time in 2010, there were beginning to be conversations about repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It seemed like that would be something that would be moving. And what I really liked about working on Obamacare is that I was kind of on a moving train as it made its way through the process. And I wanted that same opportunity. And so I said, hey, Faz, what if I started writing about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? He said, sure. And that really began to expand my abilities and my writing and my thinking into other issues. Eventually, I worked remote out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I felt like because I was not physically in the office, I had to produce a lot more content. And so that began the period in my working career at Think Progress, where I would write 10, 12 posts a day, just very intensely. It seems, you know, really kind of crazy now, but I think it really kind of crystallized and helped me hone my skills in being able to write things quickly and precisely, which, you know, is a skill I still use every single day. I came back from Cambridge in 2012, Faz announced that he would be leaving Think Progress, but said that because of my ability to produce so much content, even though I only at that point wrote about healthcare still, because as I found out, it was not going away, healthcare and LGBTQ issues, don't ask, don't tell, and all of the other issues surrounding it, that because of my great output, that I would be a good candidate to be the deputy editor under Judd, who had come back. And so that began my working relationship with Judd in a serious way. And yet again, you know, pushed me to really broaden my thinking and writing to other issues. Eventually, you know, I got to a place where I thought to myself, I've been doing this work. This was probably in 2015, in the beginning of 2015, I felt I've been writing at this publication in the same way for a really long time. Let me try something else. I began doing video in 2015. This was right before Facebook started prioritizing video and just in the beginning of political videos. I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed being on camera. I enjoyed writing scripts. And at the end of that year, I did that for a year at CAP. At the end of that year, the woman by the name of Angie Kelly, who at that point was the executive director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, was looking for a deputy. Somebody within the center had recommended me to her, and she offered me the opportunity to kind of leave progressive journalism and move into more of an advocacy role. I thought it would be a really great challenge, especially in the 2016 election. And so I moved into that role, and that kind of, you know, really changed the trajectory of my career and frankly probably allowed me to do what I'm doing now in gun violence prevention. Because had I not taken that step in a fairly safe environment, right, because I was in the same organization but just in a different role, I don't know that I would have the skill set to really do what I'm doing now.
So you had mentioned that you had fired off a tweet or tweets that kind of got you going in this. Talk about that moment and what the response was.
I believe it's December 2nd, 2015. I used to know those. It could be December 3rd. There was a shooting in San Bernardino, California. I, on that day, was filming voiceover and some on-camera stuff for a video we were working on. And so I spent the entire day in the video studio. I remember getting alerts on my phone about the shooting. I came back to my desk where I had two monitors and TweetDeck open. And on my TweetDeck, I had a special column, I still have it, for members of Congress. And that's where I first saw these thoughts and prayers. And because I had been managing editor of the site during the Newtown shooting, and I should say that this is kind of important because in Newtown was December of 2012. And that's also when Judd, who became editor-in-chief, had his baby, Mo, who's now, goodness, I can't even count how old he is now. Judd took paternity leave and he left me in charge of the blog. So I was kind of interim editor-in-chief. That was my position when Newtown happened. And so I was very involved in crafting and shaping our coverage around Newtown. And I became intimately involved with all of the different players who were trying to pass legislation that following year in 2013. And so I was able to glance at these members of Congress in my TweetDeck column and know that the ones who were most vociferous about sending thoughts and prayers spread lies about the reforms that President Obama was trying to put into place, voted against it. And so that just added to the anger. As I started to see those tweets, what I decided to do is go on to opensecrets.org, calculate how much each one of these lawmakers took from the NRA and just begin posting those numbers, right? Quote tweet every tweet and say the reason why at Paul Ryan with WI, I think is his Twitter handle, is only thinking and praying about gun violence and not actually doing anything is because he took X amount of dollars from the NRA. I did it once, I did it twice, I did it three times. And this was really before kind of the algorithm kicked in a serious way on Twitter, right? And I begin seeing more and more retweets and likes and those numbers really growing in a serious and substantial way. I start getting emails from friends of mine in different parts of DC saying, "We're watching your tweets. We're watching your tweets. Oh my God." And I think to myself, "Oh my God, this is like a real thing." By that point, it's like 8 p.m. And I'm like, "All right, let me take a break. Let me go to the gym." I go across the street. At that point, I was doing CrossFit. I take a CrossFit class. I finish the class and I think to myself, all right, I guess I should go home. But then in the back of my head, I thought, no. I should go back and see how the tweets are doing. I walk back across the street. I come back into the office. I see the tweets have blown up even more. I say to myself, I'm just going to stay here and continue doing this. I keep on doing the same thing. By that point, it must have been 10:30 or 11. I get an email from the producers of Chris Hayes' show. They say, "Hey, can you come on tonight?" Because, of course, you know, MSNBC was doing special coverage of the shooting. I went on his show. It was one of my most emotional appearances on television, I think. And then, you know, the next day, I was asked to do a package for NBC Nightly News. I did that. Lots of other media requests started coming in. And that's when I really kind of recognized that, you know, this thing really hit a nerve. I think folks really understood that politicians oftentimes represented interests that were not that of their constituents. They understood, I think, that money is involved. But I think by quantifying those specific exact numbers, it really crystallized it for people. And I think really resonated for people. And so, you know, that led to also a book agent approaching me, asking if I wanted to do a book about gun violence. It led through a series of maneuvers for an opportunity to create a gun reform organization, which eventually became the organization I run now, called Guns Down America. I did the same action several more times. The one after the Pulse shooting was probably the one that was as big, if maybe not even bigger than the first time, and really continued to build my platform and, you know, really kind of set me on a path towards thinking about this issue in a really different way and trying to understand, again, you know, how can I add value to an issue space where there are already, you know, so many great voices that have been doing this work for so long.
What is it about the gun issue that seems to have crystallized a particular anger? There's so many things to look at in our society that need reform. Why this one?
Yeah, I don't know that anyone's asked me this. Because I have worked on many different issues intensely, right? Healthcare, incredibly intensely. Don't ask, don't tell, repeal, incredibly intensely. Marriage equality, not as intensely as the other two, but fairly intensely. I also just have the kind of personality where I become obsessed with an issue and I try to understand all of the dynamics and all of the politics and all of the different opportunities. And what has always stuck out to me about the gun issue is that, unlike in many ways healthcare, although that's now changing, and certainly at that point in the late 2000s and early 2010s, all of the LGBTQ issues, that on the gun issue, there was such incredible consensus amongst the public that it was always a mystery to me about why, despite the fact that 97% of Americans support background checks, including like 90% of gun owners, why we as a country, as a movement, couldn't get that issue across the finish line. I saw that as a real challenge. And it also, I think, really stuck to the heart of, you know, what is always for me, as I mentioned, that gap between what politicians say and what politicians do, and politicians not reflecting the needs of their constituents. So I think for all of those reasons, I was drawn to the gun issue. But with that being said, you know, I was only really drawn to it when I saw the opportunities to make change within it. When I was working on it fairly intensely during the Newtown period, I felt, you know, this is such a hard issue. This is such an emotionally heavy issue that I don't know that I want to dedicate my professional life to it just because it's so, so hard. It's in many ways harder than some of the other issues that I've worked on because it's so personal and it literally involves life and death directly, right? But I think the challenge of it and that the fact that in that issue, that gap was so pronounced, that really, I think, resonated with me.
So you mentioned you had a book agent approach you, and quick look on Amazon shows a book under your name called Guns Down. Tell me about the process of putting that together and what you said.
I initially said no. I did not want to write a book. I didn't think I would like the process of writing a book. I didn't know what I would say. But it really kind of crystallized itself, partly because the agency that my agent at that time worked for, Russ Yoon, was incredibly helpful in hearing my voice, in hearing what I wanted to do. You know, the center of that book, Guns Down, How to Defeat the NRA and Build a Safer Future with Fewer Guns, contains what we ended up calling a new Second Amendment compact, which are 10 policies that I believe in changes that we need to enact to really solve our national gun crisis. That's what the book is really kind of centered on. You know, we felt, and thankfully publishers also felt, that that was an interesting approach to this issue, just kind of providing a new interpretation of our relationship with the Second Amendment and the policies that we argue, you know, could expansively fall within it. I'm grateful to them for helping craft the book and for eventually, obviously, selling the book proposal. But I'll say that, you know, after the 2016 election, I, by that point, before election day in 2016, I'd written about half the book. On election day, I stopped. And I had stopped until all the way until the Parkland shooting in February of 2018. I'd stop because I was in shock. The country was in shock. And I really dedicated myself towards doing everything I could to try and defeat what Trump was doing to the country. And you'll, of course, remember the very first thing he tried to do was to repeal Obamacare. And so given my history there, I felt I had a real value add. And so I spent really all of 2017 and into 2018 working on that incredibly, incredibly intensely and just didn't have time to work on the book. And then when Parkland happened, you know, that was a real opportunity because the country yet again kind of woke up to the horrors of gun violence, and it really lit a fire underneath me to ultimately finish it. And I did in December of 2018, and then the book came out in April of 2019.
What's the meaning for you of the phrase guns down? Is that just short for put your guns down? What does that mean?
Guns down to me means in America, we have such a, in some ways, I would say, unique relationship to firearms. That's part of our mythology. That's part of the politics surrounding that mythology, this idea that is so clear today of insurrectionism, the idea that people with guns in America are somehow super citizens who have extra rights, are able to use their guns to intimidate the democratic process. And to me, that phrase really connotates the idea of if we just put the guns down, literally, not only are we obviously going to be saving lives, but we're also maybe are able to have a very different kind of conversations across our country and are able to come together in ways that we haven't been able to in the past.
Tell me about the organization you started. What kind of organization is it? And what are the core things that you do?
So the organization came out of a recognition that while there are so many wonderful gun violence prevention organizations who have been doing this work for so many years, and we work with so many of them every single day, that there really wasn't an organized voice that was trying to do two different things. One is push corporations and other non-legislative voices to really prioritize gun reform in a serious way. And the second is to expand and shift the Overton window on both how we talk about gun reform and who's at the table to do that talking. And those are really the two significant buckets of work for Guns Down America. That first part about engaging corporations and companies is borrowed from the LGBTQ movement, from specifically the marriage equality movement. Because what that movement was able to recognize is that if they enlisted corporations into the fight for marriage equality, that they would be taking that issue out of the political arena, out of this partisan space, and they would be not only creating change within corporate culture, but they would also be creating change within culture more broadly. They would be bringing in voices, corporate voices, who could speak to different audiences, who could reach different audiences, and that would really be instrumental into attaining the goal of the marriage equality movement, which is obviously full marriage equality for LGBTQ Americans. I believed that that was really missing in the gun violence prevention movement. And so that to us became an incredible organizing principle. And it allowed us to really, I think, do a body of work that the other groups weren't doing or weren't focused on doing, I should say. It created a niche for us. It created a pathway for us. I guess, 4 years later now with 2020, 4 years later, I'm so proud to say that we've had some incredible successes in pushing companies to lean into this issue in a real way. We got Walmart after the El Paso shooting to really walk away from most kinds of gun sales and to think about gun reform as a business priority. But we did so, and this is the proud part, we did so in coalition with so many incredible organizations, not just from the gun violence prevention movement, but from across the spectrum of organizations who understood how this issue related to their missions as well. And now, really, all of the work that we do is done in collaboration with those voices, because I'm a big believer that if you're going to make progress, you have to pull in as many voices as possible, because those voices speak to different audiences. And for us to ultimately get to where we're going, we don't need everybody, but we need enough people to care, to do, to push in order to, you know, as I write in the book and as we say in our organization, to build safer communities with fewer guns.
I mean, one of the difficult challenges of running any organization is finding a way to pay your people. And
I don't know what you mean. Yes.
I'm certain you do. How do you go about that? And what has worked for you?
Well, you know, we have been incredibly fortunate to have some just very generous foundation partners, foundations that have historically funded gun violence prevention work for decades, who really, I think, recognized the importance of and the value add of the work that we do. And so we are very, I think, blessed to have those partners help fund our work and boost our work. And, you know, certainly once I left the Center for American Progress in August of 2018 and began to work on Guns Down America full-time, we've been able to expand our funding base to individuals and other folks, both, you know, high net worth individuals who are really philanthropists, but also really activate a pretty substantial grassroots fundraising program in order to help fund all of our operations.
One of the things I try to do in this podcast is help people understand how the progressive ecosystem fits together. Who are the other gun groups that you end up collaborating with, and what do you think their various different contributions are?
Oh, that is a big question, but I'll give you some examples. You know, one organization that we're working with now, that we're about to launch a project with around guns at polling places, is the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, which is just a terrific organization that approaches this work from a public health perspective, that has been so instrumental in doing the hard legislative work in passing the emergency risk protection order laws that we've seen all across the country that, as you know, remove firearms from individuals that are deemed a threat to themselves or to others. I'm so proud to partner with them and to work with them. There's certainly, of course, also Giffords, which is an organization started by Gabby Giffords, who, as you also know, was a victim of gun violence, herself is a victim of gun violence. That's an organization that does a lot of work specifically with gun owners, that also has attached to it an incredible law center called the Giffords Law Center, which is such an amazing resource and was just instrumental to when I was writing my book. There's, of course, also Everytown for Gun Safety. Attached to Everytown is an organization called Moms Demand Action, which is probably the most expansive grassroots army that our movement has and has done some just incredible work in the legislative arena on the state level, but also in building grassroots awareness and power about our issue. And then, of course, there's March for Our Lives, which came out of the Parkland shooting in February of 2018, that has really energized young people around this issue in a whole new way, and I know is now doing a lot of work around the election and getting young people to vote.
It seems to me like the gun question has become part of the polarization between the two parties to a large degree, Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other. How do you see it playing into the big 2020 election coming up?
This is such a unique election, not only because of the candidates involved, but also, of course, because of the social and political context. There's a president we have who keeps on insisting that should he lose, that people's Second Amendment rights will be immediately taken away, that the amendment itself will be taken away. That message, that false message, obviously, is really geared towards a rural white audience who sees guns and gun ownership as an expansion of culture, a culture that they feel is under threat by the changing demographics in America. I mean, that's, you know, the nice way of saying it. Secondly, there's been this entire year a real spike in gun sales, a real spike in insurrectionists and armed intimidators showing up first at the reopen rallies in April and May, then at the protests that followed the killing of George Floyd and all of the Black Lives Matter protests across the country. That continues to be the case, using their firearms to intimidate and to at times kill Americans they disagree with. We certainly saw that happen in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Guns and the issue of permissive gun laws is in play in 2020 in a way that I haven't really ever seen in my lifetime. But it's not just a political issue. It's not just a rhetorical issue. It poses in 2020 a real risk to people's safety, to people's lives, and in many ways to the stability, the future, and the health of our democracy.
It is super scary if one plays out scenarios about maybe a losing president inciting violence in the period before the inauguration of another president or after a disputed election. I don't even really want to think about it, but it's possible in a way that I don't ever remember. One of the developments that has also occurred recently is a lot of troubles for the NRA. Has that been significant enough to open a window for reform?
Well, not yet, right? Because the challenge here is with the NRA finally being exposed for the corrupt grifters that they are, the question is, do NRA members wake up and actually begin to support the kind of gun reforms they tell us they support, right? They tell pollsters that they support. And is there somebody, is there a trusted voice and a trusted messenger to organize those voices in that direction? If there is, I have not met that person. I would love to, right? The second question is in the void that the NRA will leave, because, you know, they certainly, I think, have less clout and less influence than they had just a year ago. Will the organizations that orbit the NRA, that are to the right of the NRA, will they fill that void? And then how will Republicans in Congress or conservatives in Congress respond to that? That is, if the advocacy part of the gun rights movement moves even further to the right, are you going to see Republican politicians follow suit? And thus, are we going to politically move even further away on this issue? Certainly, the fact that you have certain Republicans in the House who subscribe to QAnon and all kinds of conspiracies lends credence to the fact that there might be voices in Congress next year that have even more radical views on gun ownership than the NRA does.
Yikes. So Guns Down America, where are you trying to go? What's the plan?
Well, look, our mission, if I were to boil it down, is to push non-legislative actors, particularly businesses and corporations, to begin to approach the issue of guns in terms of a business priority in the same way that they think of climate change as now a business priority and have done so much outside of the legislative arena to make progress on that issue. In the same way that they see diversity, both within race, but also sexual orientation and gender, as a business priority for their longevity and their organization. So that's certainly going to be something that the organization is going to continue to work on and is working on. And then certainly, you know, if there's an opportunity to advance legislation to tighten our gun laws, right, that's so badly needed, I'm very interested in building the kind of broad coalition I think we will need to be successful and for that coalition to involve and include the kinds of voices that may be surprising, that speak to different audiences, and that, again, take this issue out of the realm of partisan politics.
Igor, is there a question about your group or your plans that I haven't asked that you'd like to answer?
No, you have asked me questions nobody has asked me before. So I am actually very impressed. You'd like to know what is asked me. What is the meaning of Guns Down? So I'm very impressed with the awesome questions you ask. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Anything else you want to say?
No, I think we said it all.
That was Igor Volsky. He's at gunsdownamerica.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.